Hello and welcome to Volume 5 of Capital Ideas Live, a live teleconference brought to you by the Alabama Forest Owners Association. In today's issue, we'll discuss future trends in the forest industry in Alabama, where to find answers to some of your legal questions, and the results of the recent statewide election. We'll also talk about mineral extraction on your property, how to grow hardwoods, and techniques to improve hunting habitat. We'll look at tax topics, a website with daily news of forestry, and finally, some land for sale. I'm Hayes Brown, the General Counsel of the Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. In our last issue, we discussed forest history with Tom Bonnickson, and today we'll look to the future. And to help us do that, we've invited Ken Muhlenfeld to be our first guest. Ken has for the past 11 years been the director of the Forest Products Development Center at Auburn University. The center provides information and assistance to prospective industries that may wish to locate in Alabama. Ken, let me ask you to look into the future. Who do you see emerging as the likely buyers of our wood in the future?
Well, good morning, Hayes. I think primarily what we're going to see that the forest products companies that are going to be the major players in Alabama in the coming years are probably some of the names we're already familiar with. We've had a lot of investment in the state over the last 12 to 15 years, averaging about $800 million a year in new capital investment, and most of this has come from the companies that are already here. So we expect that most of the players that we have are going to be here for the long term with that kind of investment commitment. Now, having said that, we've seen a lot of restructuring in the industry in recent times. Through mergers and acquisitions, we've lost some of the familiar names that we've been that have been big players in the state, names like Union Camp, McMillan Blodell, James River, Scott Paper, Champion International. All those were big players, and they've now become parts of larger companies through mergers or acquisitions. So we really haven't lost the manufacturing capacity. We just have fewer companies involved.
So there's a different name on the door, but it's still the same.
That's correct. And we don't think that trend is finished yet. We've had some evidence of that earlier this week where Weyerhaeuser made a $5.2 billion bid to buy Willamette Industries. So we're likely to see some more of that. Some of the big names that are emerging are International Paper Company, Weyerhaeuser, and Georgia Pacific, which are already the big three, and they're getting bigger through this process. But in addition, we've also seen some new companies come into the state in recent years, and probably we'll see some more of that, both U.S.-based and international companies. Probably the most recent and notable example of that is Norbord, a Canadian company that's building a $130 million OSB plant in Chambers County. But in general, 70 to 80% of the new investment that we will see will probably come from existing industry as it has in the past. And so I think most of the names that we will be operating with in the future are names that we already know and are familiar with.
Okay. Well, we've talked about who. Now tell us what. What products will these buyers want from us as sellers of wood?
Well, again, I think we're going to continue to see demand for the same sorts of timber products that we have in the recent past. It's kind of a slowly evolving situation that we don't expect to change quickly. Historically, what we've seen is that the forest industry has adapted to the timber available to it and not the other way around. Much of the new process technology and new product innovations that have been developed in recent years are really focused at changes in the timber resource. Either trying to make quality products from smaller, lower-cost timber or trying to be more efficient in the use of raw materials. Some of the new product areas that we've seen significant investment in are oriented strand board, medium-density fiber board, composite lumber, and laminated veneer lumber. The first three of those will utilize pulpwood-sized material, both pine and certain types of hardwood. The laminated veneer lumber, on the other hand, requires logs that are large enough to peel with a rotary lathe. But even though some of these new product technologies are exciting and we're going to see some developments there, a lot of things will be slow to change. I think there's a tremendous amount of capacity out there to manufacture conventional wood products, and that capacity is not going to go away. So we can expect there'll be significant further investment in manufacturing capacity for conventional products, and the types of timber that are going to be demanded are not going to change dramatically. It'll be a slow evolution, probably.
All right. Well, thank you, Ken, for that perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Tom McAvoy is an associate professor at the University of Vermont, and he's written a recent book called Legal Aspects of Owning and Managing Woodlands. Tom, what legal topics do you find forest owners face these days?
Well, first of all, thanks a lot for having me on this program this morning. And I should also mention before I get too far into this that I'm not a lawyer, and I think therein lies the key of having had the ability to write this book. I didn't get bogged down in details. And for some people that's troubling, but for others it's exactly the ticket they need to understand some of the legal concepts, some of the legal ideas associated with owning and managing forest lands. The book addresses many of the popular ideas that that people have about forests and what they need to know about them in order to take good care of them. For instance, private property and our concepts of private property, the bundle of rights, and protecting the public's interests when it comes to private property. Issues associated with acquiring and owning forest lands, titling of assets, the notion of how people actually own land is especially significant in these days when people tend to get married and get divorced more frequently, and there tend to be different ways of owning land than was the case in the past. Some things associated with purchasing land, some tips on what to look for and what to avoid when negotiating a purchase of forest land. Surveys and boundaries. If you, in our neck of the woods, in the 13 colonies, we have a very confusing method of survey called meets and bounds. And the thing that's confusing about it is that each parcel is referenced by its own point. And there's the problem. Without a common reference point, there's all kinds of room for discrepancy. And in fact, it is the number one legal dispute among forest landowners in the original colonies, our property boundary disputes.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's an entire chapter that deals with surveys and boundaries and some of the legal aspects of that and what landowners need to know. But the premise of the book is pretty much built on the idea that you're better off knowing how to ask the right question than having answers to all the wrong questions.
So it can give some cues to landowners who may have questions, perhaps that they can't voice at this particular time. It can serve as a way to have them consult their own legal advisor.
Exactly. Questions, actually, perhaps even that the legal advisor may not have considered. Issues such as establishing forest management objectives and how those forest management objectives become kind of the guiding principle for the current owner, as well as who might succeed that current owner. In other words, how do you pass the land and those objectives onto another generation? And in fact, planning for woodlands in your estate is another one of the chapters that I deal with. Not only from the perspective of conservation of assets, which seems to be the principal reason people delve into estate planning, but from the perspective of how do you pass land intact to future generations in such a way that management strategies that you put in place today will be maintained for your heirs in the future.
All right. Well, if you're interested in obtaining a copy of the book, you can get it through the website at barnesandnoble.com, where we have a link. Also, AFOA is placing 116 copies in the public libraries around the state, and we have a limited offer for members who wish to purchase your book for the very attractive price of $19. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
The state of Alabama has in the past developed an unfriendly reputation for business, but that's changing. Phyllis Kennedy is with us to discuss the recent statewide election. She's the Alabama State Director of the National Federation of Independent Business. Phyllis, how did small businesses come out in the November 2000 elections?
Well, we were thrilled with what happened in the elections. We won 5 seats on the Alabama Supreme Court and 3 seats on the Court of Civil Appeals, which is far more than we ever even dared to hope for.
What's the composition now of Republicans to Democrats on the Supreme Court in Alabama?
You know, I think that it is 8 Republicans and 1 Democrat. I saw it listed someplace this week as being 8 restrained and 1 activist, and I assume that that's what that means. We try not to deal in party labels as much as in the fairness of a candidate, but
or just their judicial philosophy.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, were small business issues prevalent during these races? Were these kind of things talked about?
Well, actually not, because in a judicial race, you don't talk about issues a whole lot. You can't ask somebody how they would vote on a particular question or try to pin them down on any issue. So what you are looking for in a judicial candidate is somebody who pledges to give a fair interpretation of the law, to give it in the literal way that the legislature has written the law, and not get into reinterpreting the law in order to suit their own preferences or the preferences of their friends who might be appearing before them.
Mm-hmm. Well, that does provide some stability then, some way for businesses to plan if
right.
they don't have to plan on someone reinterpreting a law that's
right.
on their books.
I love that. As I mentioned, the way that I saw somebody describe these people as 8 restrained and 1 activist. You know, activist judges are the last thing that we want on our courts, because that's what we've suffered from in Alabama for the past, I guess, 10 years or so, when the people in the plaintiff's trial bar decided that they were going to try to put their friends on the courts, and they just tore down tort reform legislation that had been passed in 1987 and rewrote it to suit themselves.
Mm-hmm. What changes, if any, should forest landowners expect to receive or expect to see as a result of the election? Do you think that there'll be anything that's noticeable to forest landowners?
Well, I hope that one of the things that will be noticeable is that insurance will be more available in Alabama and will be less costly when you're looking at general liability insurance, which I assume is a concern for mm-hmm. any landowner.
Okay. Well,
and the other thing would be that I hope that we'll be looking at a general attitude of that is more a business prosperity and friendliness to business. You know, mm-hmm. we've had developed an attitude, and not necessarily an attitude in Alabama, but we've developed a reputation in Alabama that is not friendly to business, and people are very wary of coming to locate in this state. I
okay.
hope that we will have eliminated that.
Great. Well, thank you for joining us, Phyllis.
Thank you.
If you're fortunate enough to have minerals like coal, oil and gas, or coal bed methane on your land, you may think that you have to make a choice between extracting these minerals or growing timber. Dr. Charles Haynes is a mining and petroleum engineer by training, and he's a professor in the Civil and Environmental Engineering Department at the University of Alabama. Dr. Haynes, what should a forest owner know about surface mining?
Okay, Hayes, I appreciate the opportunity to be with you today, and I still feel somewhat like the intruder at the party, although by the time I'm through, I guess we could say that the extractive industries and the forest growers really have something in common.
Well, we're glad to have you at the table.
Let's just say that you're a surface owner. You don't own any mineral interest in the property, and perhaps in Alabama, although it could be anywhere. And a mining operator wants to lease your surface acreage for a fairly immediate mining. They don't normally go out way in advance. And you're offered a bonus, perhaps up front, a nominal amount of money, and then a damage payment for your surface, and it might be based on each ton of coal or other mineral removed. We're also going to assume that this is not a stone quarry where you just you might say end up with a lake and a subdivision around it later on, that there will be reclamation. The mining operator has filed and is approved, let's say has had approval by the state regulatory agencies as to reclamation plan, and there's going to be a permit to mine. Now, in the past, this might thrill you because there might be a considerable amount of money up front. What I'm seeing as time goes on, though, is that the coal mining operators are getting smaller and smaller. Their capitalization is getting thinner and thinner. And sometimes it's mining on an iffy basis because of markets. I'm not going to go into the politics, but I have some strong feelings about how the Fed and perhaps even state governments feel about the mining of coal, let's say, versus the extraction of natural gas, but that's another story. If you can do so, you should get very interactive with the mining operator up front. If you intend to sign a legal document with that operator, you should know something about the mine plan. The mine plan can be obtained at the regulatory agency in Alabama. It's the Alabama Surface Mining Commission. Plan to get with the operator face-to-face. Find out what he plans to do and how fast. Know what the market is likely to be and how secure that market might be. You can go to the Surface Mining Commission and find out something about the operator. You can get information beforehand that could at least place you in a wary position or a position of comfort as time goes on. Once mining begins, you will have decided and worked out with the operator just how much timber you need to move in advance of mining. Don't clear-cut large areas. It's not necessary. Mining may not move that fast. You may find in iffy markets that the operator may leave you because of economic conditions, even could come back later. So you've got a trade-off there with clear-cutting, particularly timber you're not quite ready to cut, and then looking at how much you might get or how little you'd get as royalty, or I should not say royalty, but damage payments as mining progresses.
All right. Well, it sounds like there's a great deal of interaction that needs to take place between the landowner and the mining operator and find out some more about what he's doing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I'd suggest the forest owner get very, very familiar with mining. You can do it through a consultant, advisors, or just through reading.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dr. Haynes. We appreciate that perspective on surface mining. Forest owners who grow pine trees seem to have a great deal of information available to them, but those that want to grow hardwood, and that's the right kind of hardwood, are constantly searching for information on how to do the best job. David Merker is with us.
Yes.
David?
Yes.
You've been interested in showing us how we can grow hardwoods. What do you mean by crop tree release?
Sure. Well, when compared to pine crops, the long length of time necessary to grow quality hardwood trees is perhaps one of the greatest deterrents that prevents private landowners from practicing hardwood management, because valuable hardwood trees like red oak and white oak and so forth often take decades to reach their financial maturity. So crop tree release is a way to energize your forest crop. Through crop tree release, the growth rate is enhanced on individual trees, forest composition is improved, harvest rotation is shortened, and landowners receive a sort of a revived enthusiasm for their forest land.
Well, once you pick the trees that you'd like, the ones you've described, how do you go about releasing them and helping them to grow?
Sure. There's several steps involved in crop tree release. First of all, let me say I'm applying this to younger stands that are typically in about 4 to 8 inches in diameter at breast height. And as with any investment involving land and crops, the first step is to apply crop tree release on your best sites first. And this would include sites with deep and fertile and moist soils, sites protected from hot and dry southwest winds, sites where hardwood trees can typically reach a height of about 70 to 75 feet in 50 years. We say a site index of 70 to 75. The next step, then, is to select stands with desirable species. Now, not all of your best sites are composed of tree species worthy of crop tree release. So you're looking for trees that have traditionally commanded the highest market price in the southeast, and that's your white and red oak groups. But also, market cycles periodically cause sharp increases in price for alternative species, such as yellow poplar or black cherry or black walnut. So it's important to manage for a diversity of tree species that you can benefit from uncertain future markets. Now, once you've chosen the best sites and your best trees, the next step is to begin releasing your crop trees. And you need to condition your eye to locate trees needing release, not trees needing deadened. In other words, find those dandy crop trees out there. Typically, that would be trees that are healthy, those with potential for further development, trees with a good form. In other words, they're straight and with few forks. Trees with better grade, in other words, few knots. And then those that are in the upper levels of the forest canopy, you don't want to try to release trees that have been suppressed for a long time. The next step, then, is just to using equipment, and normally I would recommend a small chainsaw, and actually identify the trees to deaden and cut a girdle or a ring around the trees at a comfortable height normally about 3 foot above the ground. And this would be a girdle that's about 1 inch thick, and then duplicate the girdle. In other words, make a second cut approximately 6 inches from the first one.
Okay, and that's how you'll kill the trees that you do not want.
That's right.
Okay.
It's much like weeding a garden, only on a larger scale.
Okay. Well, thank you for that perspective. Well, it's hunting season in Alabama. Landowners are becoming very active in enhancing their land to produce the highest quality wildlife habitat. We're joined by John Johnson, who's with Purcell Industries in Sylacauga, Alabama. Now, he's been active in promoting a certain type of fertilizer that can benefit naturally occurring plants that are favored by wildlife. John, what would you like landowners to know about how their land supports deer?
Well, I tell you what, Hayes, first of all, thank you for having me on the conference call this morning. I'm glad to be here. And, you know, this is a project that I guess I undertook about 10 years ago on my piece of property, just kind of for some love of the outdoors and enjoying being around wildlife. And what I would tell people is that most people go in and, you know, they actually try to plant green fields in the fall of the year so that they have a place to hunt. And realistically, they ought to, you know, probably step back and take a long-term view at this and say, you know, what can I do to increase the total herd or increase the, you know, the management style that I want, if that's, you know, a buck-to-doe ratio or if that's, you know, larger bucks or, you know, if they just want to see a lot of deer. Think about that and then start looking at ways that they can improve that. One of the ways that I promote them improving that is through total vegetation management, which, since most of your wildlife are browsers, and that means that they pick up, you know, native plants, they eat native plants that are contained within the different forests and habitat that they, you know, travel in a day's time. Improving those habitats first and then supplementing those with food plots during critical times of the year, which are spring and fall.
So you're not talking about simply just planting a food plot for one specific hunting season, but you're talking about the whole year long.
That's correct. And, I mean, basically, if you look at the native plants that are contained within these, you know, these different areas, what these are native, and, you know, they grow right there. They're adaptable to those climates. And by improving that native habitat, what you really do is you provide just a wealth of food there for your wildlife. And, you know, one way to go in and improve that is by the application of fertilizers to that.
Okay, and how does that work all during the year?
Well, what I recommend people do is to go in and at first green up, make an application of fertilizer. A lot of people try to go in and use the balanced fertilizer or a 1-to-1-to-1 ratio of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. Do that at first green up, and do this in kind of large areas. You don't want to go out and just do a real small area of, say, Japanese honeysuckle, because deer will come in and just destroy them because they do seek out higher quality nutritious plants.
Okay. Well, we appreciate your work there in the fertilizer industry and helping landowners more effectively manage their land for deer habitat.
Well, thank you, Hayes. And I tell you what, I would ask that people check out the two websites that are listed, Auburn University's Extension Service and also Mississippi State's webpage, as well as Quality Deer Management Association.
Okay. Thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
William Schlosser is with us next. Mr. Schlosser publishes ForestTax.com, a newsletter that's available on a subscription basis, which deals with tax issues related to forestry. Mr. Schlosser, give us an idea of what topics are found in the ForestTax.com newsletter.
Thank you for having me on the program. What we try to cover in that newsletter is any current events that are going on with forest tax management. It's often a topical to the time of the year, whether it's tax season or a time of the year when we're working on a lot of planning type issues. A lot of strategies is what we focus on. Strategies on how to minimize tax liability and take advantage of the federal tax code.
Now, do subscribers have the opportunity to join a chat room with other forest owners to discuss tax issues?
Well, it's a low-tech tax chat room. In other words, what it is a list server. People send mail to an address that is resent to all the subscribers of the program, and that is just generated through email messages. So somebody poses a question, that question goes out to everybody, and then the answer comes out following that. and just a lot of landowner discussion on tax issues is facilitated over that.
Mm-hmm. Haven't you also made available some record-keeping software, like a template that can help keep track of records and so forth for forest owners?
Yes, we have, and that's something that has really grown over the last few years. We have the website myforest.com with a hyphen between the my and forest. And at myforest.com, we sell quite a few things for the forest landowner. Those include a tax template, as you had mentioned, which works with the QuickBooks Pro software, or QuickBooks software. It's a chart of accounts for the forest landowner to open and begin entering their business activities in forestry on. It goes a long ways towards proving our active trader business involvement, and also is a great tax planning tool. We also complement that with a 45-minute video that we've developed on federal forest land taxes. It's written for the forest landowner. It's explained very clearly and in a way that you can really walk away from watching that video, understanding how you have to structure your forest land activities to take advantage of the federal tax code. That's really our complication in forestry, is a lot of the tax code was not written for forestry. It was written for different types of businesses. And so what we do is try to help the forest landowner merge those two fields and take advantage of it.
All right. Well, thank you very much. For those of you who are interested in this topic, there are two links to foresttax.com and myforest.com. Thank you, Mr. Schlosser.
Thank you, Hayes.
For many of us, the way that we receive the news is changing. Bill Olson has been a pioneer in providing news summaries, particularly related to forestry, at advancedforestry.com. He joins us from Colorado. Bill, I've visited the website several times, and I'm amazed at the number of news stories that are related to forestry specifically. Where do you find these stories?
Hi, Hayes. What I do is I use different news utilities that are available on the Internet and search for a variety of topics that are related to forestry and forest resources. And then I pair through those and look for items that are of interest to people that manage and own forest lands.
How often do these stories get posted?
I post every day during the course of the week, Monday through Friday. And on occasion I may get to it on weekends if I have a chance. But the actual news that's coming from the media, there's obviously a lot going on. It varies, of course, with what's going on in the world. Like, for example, I understand that with the presidential election recently, and the media kind of tilts away from that, and then they show up again. But there's a wide assortment available out there, and if we just rely on our local newspapers, or even newspapers just in the major urban areas, we get very limited information. But the Internet has made so much information available to folks that have the time or the ability to track it down, and that's what I'm able to do, and that's what I offer at advancedforestry.com on the news page.
Okay, and that address is www.advancedforestry.com, right?
Right.
Okay. In our last couple of minutes, we're joined by Louis Olivier. If you're in the market for some more forest land, you'll be interested in what Louis is about to say. He's with Alliance Forest Products. Louis, I believe you've got some land for sale.
Yes, thanks for inviting me. Yes, we have 52 parcels of land for sale that total about 9,100 acres in 10 counties in central Alabama. The majority of it is in Bibb County, about 3,000 acres, but other than that, they're scattered pretty evenly from Calhoun to Cleburne, Clay, Shelby, St. Clair, Talladega, and Tallapoosa County.
Have these tracts been managed for forest land?
Yes. These tracts have been managed for the last 30 years for southern pines, primarily loblolly pine. Most of the tracts have plantations established ranging from 1 to 28 years old. And there are about six parcels that have either natural timber on them or they have been harvested recently and not replanted.
All right, when is the bid opening for these tracts?
The bid opening is on January 16th.
And if you'd like to get a bid package, how would you get that?
The simplest way is to email us. I believe AFO has
our
email address,
mm-hmm.
and also they can request a package by mail. The address is 17589 Plant Road, Coosa Pines, Alabama, 35044. I believe you have that address. Also, it's important that anyone that requests this package put a bid package on the envelope so it will come straight to us.
Okay, put bid package on there.
Yes.
Well, thank you for joining us, Lewis.
Sure.
That's all the time we have for this session. While you're visiting our website, be sure and find out what services are offered by the Alabama Forest Owners Association. Interesting meetings, an informative newsletter, timber buyer lists, hunting insurance, and much more. And be sure to join us on January 17th at 10 o'clock Central for our next conference. On behalf of the association, I'm Hayes Brown, thanking you for joining us for Volume 5 of Capital Ideas Live.